Thank you. Thank you. My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. That's nice. I want to repudiate that introduction. I don't want to start in a hole and have to work my way up. I don't know. I come from a town outside the city of Chicago, Orland Park, and I've been sober since November 3rd, 1971. See, I'm going to get all the statistics out of the way and make a couple announcements. I'm married to the same lady for 25 years. I'm a member of the Lamont Oaks Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an AA speaker. Now, I say that for me. I don't say that for you. I say that for me because over the past number of years, I've been casting a role doing a lot of speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid of what that might do to me. I'm afraid that if I'm not careful, I might come to believe that I'm a speaker and not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen a lot of speakers float out of the top of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want that to happen to me. So I'm proud to be a member of the Lamont Oaks Group, and I'm happy to be here. Statistics. You know, they say in Alcoholics Anonymous there's really no format to what we're supposed to talk about. Although the big book says that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we are like now. Sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I travel around, I hear it said what it was like and what happened and what it is like now. And I think there's a big difference. I think it's what I'm like, was like, and am like. I think there's a big difference. And maybe we'll develop a little about that. See, I don't have any planned talk. I don't know what I'm going to say. I'm just going to talk about whatever comes to my mind because the only subject here is alcoholism, and the only restriction is that I'm to talk about my alcoholism because I don't know anything about yours. I'm not going to talk about drinking. I'm not going to give a lot of stories about what happened and what I did and how it worked. And I'm tired of talking about drinking. I think there's more to Alcoholics Anonymous and there's more to alcoholism than drunkenness or drinking. For you who are alcoholics in this room, you know everything there is to know about drinking. There's no sense me talking about drinking. You know more than I know, or at least as much as I do, about drinking. I'd like to talk about the recovery from alcoholism. I'd like to spend a little time and do that. I understand, and I got in here late because of other commitments. I understand that you've been favored with some fine AA talks, the Al-Anon talks. This is going to be the shortest one you're going to have to endure this weekend. I want to get right to the point. My earliest recollection of me is when I was 6 years old. I have no idea what happened before I was 6 years old. I have no recollection whatsoever. But when I was 6 years old, two important things happened to me. When I was 6 years old, my father told me that I had to be a lawyer. I was afraid of my father, and I wanted to always please my father. See, my father was a drinker, and we were afraid of him. And he had some kind of idea that his sons were to be somebody. So by the time I was 6 years old, it was pounded into me that I had to be somebody. Now, he told me that 5,000 times during my sixth year. That I have to be somebody. You know what I got? I concluded from that? I concluded that I was nobody. Now, I don't know that he meant that, but I concluded that my life's job was to be somebody because I was nobody. And he said, a lawyer is somebody and you're going to be a lawyer. I didn't know what the hell a lawyer was. When you're 6 years old, the kids in the neighborhood talk about when they grow up what they want to be, and they wanted to be race car drivers and pilots and athletes and firemen and policemen. And when they'd ask me, I said, I want to be a lawyer. They didn't know what a lawyer was either. I've been a lawyer now for 25 years, and I still don't know what the hell a lawyer is. Be a lawyer, be somebody. Be a lawyer, be somebody. When I was 6 years old, I knew what I wanted to be. It wasn't a lawyer. I've known what I wanted to be since the girl next door and I built a tent out of some old blankets. I wanted to be a gynecologist. I've long since been tired of being a lawyer, but I can't imagine ever being tired of being a gynecologist. I don't know. God. When I was six, I heard about God. For the first time in my life, I went into a school that taught about God. And a lady dressed in black and white came into a classroom one day, and she said to the kids of that classroom, "I'm going to teach you about God, and I'm going to teach you about sin." As if they went together somehow. She said there are two kinds of sin. The first kind is venial sin, and that's what we're going to talk about today. It was as if she unfolded a scroll. 1,000 things were on that scroll. She said everything that's on that list is sinful. If you do any of those things and you die, God has got to punish you because you're not perfect and you have offended God. And he's got to get even. You've got to be punished. I looked at that list. I'm 6 years old, and I see a lot of things on that list I had done. Thought to myself, I got to be punished. She said, it's not so bad. You see, if you just do those things and you die, you go to a place called purgatory. And there you got to burn. Now I'm 6 years old. She said, that's not so bad either. Because you see, if you just do the things on that list, you only have to burn for 3,000 or 4,000 years. Next day, mortal sin. Not so many things on that list. I look at that list. She said, if you do any of these things and you die, you're doomed. Because you've offended God, and God's got to get even, and you've got to be punished. I looked at that list. I'm 6 years old. Those things look to me to be desirable. I think to myself, I've never done any of those things, and I intend to do every one of them at least once. I look at one of those things on that list had to do with other people's wives. I thought, now that's something you got to do. At least once. Later in life, I found out in some cases, once is not enough. So I got an idea early on, and I don't know that they ever said it that way. And that's the wonderful thing about this. I don't know if that lady ever said those things. I heard them that way. I don't know that the other kids heard them that way. But when I was 6 years old, I knew that my destiny was to be punished because I had offended God. By the time I was 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I had thoughts that I was sure were not normal thoughts. Anything that had to do with sex, I knew was dirty. And I knew that I had a preoccupation with thinking about sexual things. And I knew that somehow that I was dirty. And I knew that God was going to punish me, and that was my destiny. It's kind of hard to go out and have a full and happy life when you know that by the time you're 7 or 8, that you're whatever you are, but you have to be punished. Now, that's my concept of God that I carried on for my life until sometime after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's an unfortunate way to live. And I don't blame anyone for that. That's how I heard it, and that's what it was. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how I was. I was never a social drinker. I was never a social drinker. If you're new and you still fathom the idea secretly that you would like to be a social drinker, I'm here to tell you that if I had a pill that could make you a social drinker, you would not take that pill. Now, some of you, I know, are secretly saying, yes, I would. And I'm going to tell you, no, you won't. Because I'm going to tell you what a social drinker is. And I never was one, but I observe them every day. Social drinkers, when two social drinkers decide to go to a bar and have a drink, they do exactly that. They go to a bar and they have a drink. And then they leave. How would you like to live like that? Social drinkers leave drinks half drunk. And they leave them. Can't understand that. They do that. Do you ever see social drinkers sit at a bar and the bartender puts drinks in front of them? You know what they do? They continue to talk. How would you like to live like that? Social drinkers, when asked to have their second or third drink, say, no, thank you, I'm starting to feel it. You see what happens for a social drinker When they have their second or third or fourth drink, they feel a change occur. The change is they start feeling different. The alcohol has some effect on them and they feel some change occur. They start to feel different and they start to see things differently. They don't want to feel different and they don't want to see things differently. And they say, no, thank you. Because when that change starts to occur, that is foreign and contrary and contradictory for them, and they don't want that. Folks, if you're like me, I drink because I don't like the way I feel, and I want to change it. And I drink to make everything out there look different than how it appears to me. And I think that is the difference between people like me and social drinkers. So I never was a social drinker. And I wouldn't want to be one if I could. There's just no fun in social drinking. I mean, you don't get any crises. They don't know anything about fear and guilt and remorse. I mean, they have no idea. I have something to do with a beginner's group where I come from. And I love that group. And I have about 100 beginners in the group on a regular basis. People who have less than a year of sobriety, they range from 2 or 3 weeks to 4 or 5 months, and they stay in that group until they get a year of sobriety. And several years ago, I asked them to make an alcoholic. I said, you know, we talk about alcoholic, 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 and nobody's ever said to me or shown me what the hell we're talking about. You see, I tell you that I'm an alcoholic, and I cannot with words prove that to you. And I could stand here for hours today and talk and tell you about drunken episodes and never really be able to prove to you that I'm an alcoholic. The only way I could prove to you that I was an alcoholic is to drink again and allow you to watch how I live when I drink. And then you would know that I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not willing to do that. I'm just going to tell you that I'm an alcoholic. I wish that the New York office, after you're sober 10 years or 5 years or 15 years, would give you a badge that says, yes, he really is an alcoholic. And then you don't have to go into all these drunkologues and war stories. That's just my opinion. So I got an imaginary test tube some years ago, and I put it up and I said, give me the essence of alcoholic. What's an alcoholic? Let's make one. Fill this test tube with the ingredients that will make an alcoholic in living technicolor. And there was silence in that room. And at that time, there were probably 50 newcomers in that room. And I waited for them to start to fill the test tube. And I just held it. And I refused to do anything but sit there, stand there quietly holding that test tube. And after the longest minute, the little girl in the back of the room said, put in fear. So we put in fear. Another guy in the back of the room put in self-hatred. And I knew we were onto something. Put in depression. Put in insecurity. Put in anger. Put in ego. Put in inferiority. Put in anxiety. Put in sensitivity. And they went on and on and on and on, and they kept filling this test tube until it was overflowing. And then I said the test tube was full, almost. And you know the one thing they did not put in? And I said to them, you know, folks, maybe you know something I don't know. There's something you haven't put in yet. And a man who'd been sober about 7 weeks said, and put in some alcohol. And you know what happened? When we put that alcohol on top of all those intense emotions, the alcohol diluted those emotions. And if you're not an alcoholic, you say, well, that's no big deal. All those are human emotions. I felt every one of those emotions one time or another. Well, I'm an alcoholic. I don't feel those emotions. That's who I am. That's who I am. And when I first put alcohol into my test tube, that alcohol diluted those emotions to the point that I was able to live with them. So when I found alcohol, I found the best thing I ever found in my life. It made me manageable, functional. It made me be able to perform. Because you see, for me, I don't know if it worked for you, but early on when I found alcohol, I found a miracle occurred. If I put just enough alcohol in my test tube, the fear went away. If I put just enough alcohol in my test tube, anxiety subsides. If I put just enough alcohol in my test tube, guilt goes away. I can put alcohol in my test tube and all the dirties of the past disappear. And that's a marvelous, marvelous thing. And I found that, and that worked for me for a lot of years. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. During that period, I put more alcohol in that test tube. You know why? Because, you see, if a little bit of alcohol has such a wonderful effect, can you imagine what more alcohol would have? So I put more alcohol in there. And you know what? It diluted them some more. I didn't know that I was going to have a disease called alcoholism. And the strange thing about that illness, as I perceive it, is at some point in time, the alcohol stops diluting. And in my mentality, when I sense that's occurring, I know what's happening. I'm not putting enough in. So I spent the last 10 years of my drinking putting more and more in so that the fear and the anxiety and the whatever would go away. And what happened was, not only did it stop diluting, it compounded and exaggerated the things already there. And then a strange thing, and they call that alcoholism. And I didn't understand that when it was happening to me. I had no idea at all that that was happening to me. And in that meantime, I was growing up, and I was trying to be a lawyer, and I was trying to be a husband, and I was trying to be a father, and I was trying to be whatever you wanted me to be. Because one of the things that was in my test tube was a requirement that I be approved of. I spent most of my life trying to win the favor of others. Trying to look like I'm okay, trying to act like I'm okay, and trying to get your approval, whoever you are. And during my drinking career, I'd almost die for your approval. Never dawned on me when I was in that phase of my life that my approval had any credence. It was always perform and be somebody and make them think you're okay. And that's kind of a hard way to live. During the early stages, alcohol worked well, and I was a beer drinker. I went to college, and I was a beer drinker, and I had a great capacity to drink beer. I also was a coward. I don't know where I got that idea. Somehow, because maybe I was afraid of my father, I don't know. I got the idea when I was a young kid that I was a coward. So I became a fighter. Because I found out early on in life that if you have this shortcoming, the best way to cover it up is to exhibit an opposite kind of character. So I became a boxer. And for about 7 years, I participated in amateur boxing, and I was a good fighter. I was a good fighter because, you see, I outclassed all the kids. You see, in the Golden Gloves and the CYO and invitational tournaments and college tournaments, most of the people that were fighting in those tournaments were doing it for the love of the sport. And when they got into the ring, they were doing it as sportsmen. When I got in there, I did it for my life. Because, see, I can't lose. I can't stand the concept of losing for fear of what you may think. See? So when I'm in there, I'm fighting for my life, and this guy next to me or across from me or in front of me, he's fighting for sport. He has no chance. Because I'll die before I lose. That's kind of a sad way to live life. It really is. Most of my life I have been plagued with a feeling of ill at ease. Now, I don't know why that is. You see, when I was a kid and I foresaw growing up, all I ever wanted to do was to be happy. That's all I ever wanted to do. I never wanted to really prove anything. I just wanted to be happy. It dawned on me some years later that my problem long before alcohol was definition. Now, I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but I had a definition problem. I would hear you say things that I had no concept of. You would use the word happy. In normal and everyday conversation, you would talk about being happy. I have no understanding of the term happy. And all the time I grew up until the time that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea what that meant, happy. How can you be happy when you're plagued with guilt? How can you be happy when you're plagued with inferiority? How could you be happy when every day of your life you're trying to pretend something you are something that you're not? Because, see, that's who I was, and I never intended that to be. So you would use the term happy, and I had no idea what the hell you were talking about. Comfortable. You would say that word like it would just trip right out of your tongue. Comfortable. I'm comfortable. I had no idea what comfortable is. I know that I am always uncomfortable. I am hardly ever in a place that I'm comfortable. That's how I grew up, and that's how I became a man. I have no idea of comfortable. I'm either performing or rejected. I either have to be at the top of my game or I don't want to play the game. See? Comfortable. Enough. My God, I heard that word thousands of times. Enough. I never knew enough. I have no idea what enough is. I have no idea what enough love is, what enough money is, what enough sex is, what enough friends are, what enough prestige is. I have no idea. I never knew. I had no idea what those things were. But when I drank alcohol, they seemed to make some sense to me. I found comfort when I drank alcohol, and I seemed to be able to get enough for the moment of whatever it was. Now, that's a strange kind of thing. And I don't know if alcohol does that to everybody, but it did it to me. And I loved it. And I used it until it stopped working for me. And then I refused to accept that fact, and I drank for many years after I knew it hadn't worked. Because I just knew that somehow, somewhere, I'd learned the ability, I'd recapture the ability to be able to have alcohol work for me again. To be able to put just enough alcohol in my test tube so I could be what you wanted me to be. And I felt that if I got your approval, somehow I would get mine. What a terrible way to live. In the meantime, I became a very successful lawyer in my mind and by my father's standards. And I always thought that maybe that was the answer, that if you got enough, or if you got a lot, you'd be happy. And the more I got, the less happy I was. I never could quite understand that. It made no sense to me whatsoever. And through these years, there was alcohol and alcoholism. Near the end of my drinking, I became a shaker. I weighed 240 pounds when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. That wasn't my best fighting weight, by the way, I'll tell you. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I had never lost an amateur fight. And when I stopped fighting in the ring and I started to indulge myself into alcoholic living, I also was a fighter. And I never won a fight after that. I was 240 pounds when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I must have looked like I was 60 years old. I don't know. I don't know because I hadn't looked in a mirror for about 3 years. Because, see, I didn't like what I saw in that mirror, and I refused to look in a mirror. I had become what I thought was a successful lawyer, whatever the hell that is, but I never found any comfort, and I pursued that ability or lack of to drink. By this time, I had become a shaker. That's all the way to live. And if you're young and you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I know you're going to say, well, I'd never drink that long or I'd never do that. You got to be dumb to do that. You know, I never intended to drink that much that long to become a shaker. As a matter of fact, I had never, ever intended to be an alcoholic. Now, you may not believe this, but I did not sign the yearbook as life's goal, alcoholic. See, my life's goal was not to be in this city, giving an AA talk. My life's goal was to live happily ever after. I just didn't know how to do that. And alcohol was the thing that gave me the closest to an answer to how to do that. Living as a shaker is a very difficult thing, especially when you're trying to pretend you're a young and up-and-coming superstar lawyer. People are distracted when you shake. I had to learn a new way of life. And I'm a shaker. See, by the time I was a year into my shakes, I had to give up eating with utensils. I couldn't have soup. I couldn't handle a coffee cup. But I found another fact out. If I drink, the shakes go away. And that's true. I drank to the point that I had a drink to get rid of the shakes, and intellectually I knew that the drinking caused the shakes, but the drink can make the shakes go away. And I lived into that life for the last 3 years of my drinking, and I never intended to do that. I'm too smart to let that happen to me. It just cannot happen. That's a pathetic way to live, and that has something to do with alcoholism, and that was uncontrollable, and I never wanted that to happen, and I couldn't have wished that. As a drinker, as a shaker, I had to learn how to drink differently. Because you see, by this time in my life, I switched from beer to vodka martinis because I had the illusion that lawyers ought to drink a classier drink. So I switched from beer to vodka martinis. And I used to like them straight up. I found out that I couldn't drink them straight up anymore because you see, that stem is not wide enough. It does not allow me to put two hands around it, because you see, I need two hands to drink. That's a pathetic way to live. I never intended to live that way. I discovered something that if you are not certain that you're an alcoholic and someday resume drinking and find that you're a shaker, I'm going to give you my secret. What you do is you create a pivot point on your arm. At a table or at a bar, you put as much pressure as you can on a point halfway between your elbow and your wrist, and you apply as much pressure as you can, and you use that lever to get the drink to your mouth. And if you can drink two or three of those drinks, the shakes will go away. That doesn't impress you, but I'll tell you, it was a hell of a discovery when I found it. I called Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time when I was 30 years old. By this time, I had acquired more financial security and what I felt was success than I ever dreamed possible for me. And I was drinking myself half to death trying to maintain that image, which I knew I wasn't. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 30 years old. I got a recorded message. I called a number that I found out of a suburban phone book. And it was a woman's voice, and she said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, can I help you?" You know what I did? I hung up the phone. You know what happened when I hung up the phone? I got a good feeling. Yeah, I got a good feeling because I knew I had done something about my drinking. I took an inventory. See, I knew about inventories long before you told me about inventories. And if you're new, maybe you've taken an inventory. I'll tell you how my inventory goes. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I was 30 years old. I'm employed. I've never been fired. I'm self-employed. That's why I've never been fired, but that doesn't seem to matter. I live in a big house on top of a hill. I've got three little girls who I squander money on. I take a lot of vacations. How could I be an alcoholic? I've got 3 degrees hanging on my wall. How could I be an alcoholic? I'm too cute to be an alcoholic. I said to myself, "You're not an alcoholic. What you are is a guy who's full of sensitivities and conflicts. And alcohol used to work for you. Now you've got a lot of responsibilities, and they're hard to handle. And all you're doing is trying to relax. The problem, Frank, is not drinking. The problem is how you're drinking. What you got to do is you got to choreograph your drinking. You got to change drinks, or change the way you drink, or when you drink, or who you drink with. That makes sense to me," I say. "I'm not an alcoholic. Close my eyes. Take a picture. Picture an alcoholic. What do you see?" "I don't know. I asked the beginners that last Tuesday night." I said, "Close your eyes. Get everything out of your eyes, out of your mind's eye, and picture an alcoholic." And these are people brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous. "What do you see?" I looked at the women, and I said, "What do you see? Do you see a woman?" And not one of those women reported at seeing a woman. Isn't that a funny dilemma? I don't know what that means. I said to the men, "What do you see?" All of those people, and there were 100 of them in the room, pictured an old, dirty, pathetic man. And I'm 30 years old, and I think I got something going for me because I've fooled enough people to acquire whatever it is that I had required. I can't be an alcoholic, because that's my picture, too, of an alcoholic. So I tried to drink some more, and I tried to drink differently. I had no control how much I drank and what I drank, and I switched drinks so many times I can't even remember. I remember the end, though. Well, I was in a country club one night, and I have my wife told me about this afterwards. She said, before we left, in front of you was two bottles of beer, one half drunk. There was a VO 7-Up. There was a vodka martini. There was a rum and coke. And there were several other drinks. And I don't understand that kind of drinking. So the next time I went to that club, I decided I'm not going to... That's bizarre. If people see that you drink like that, and it doesn't matter what you drink, they're not going to think you're a sharp, up-and-coming superstar lawyer. They might think you're just crazy. So I decided the next time I would go there that I would drink a drink that would not get me weird and bizarre, and a drink that I wouldn't like. See, you got to be smart about this, and I concluded if I drank a drink I did not like and one that didn't really taste good for me, I wouldn't drink enough to embarrass myself or to make things happen that I didn't plan on happening. That night I decided to drink green cream de mint. I figured it's a ladies' drink, and who the hell would drink a lot of green cream de mint? Well, how much green cream de mint can you drink? Well, I'll tell you how much green cream de mint I could drink. The next day I got up. My lips were green. My teeth were green. My tongue was green. And everything that exited my body for 3 days was green. And I looked down and there's this stream of green, and I don't want to be Irish. And I say, I don't want to live like this. See, I have no control. I have no idea what I'm going to drink and how much I'm going to drink or what I'm going to drink. And this is where I am at this time in my life. I call Alcoholics Anonymous again. Now I'm 32 years old, and I have gone through all kinds of terrible things that serve no purpose to tell you. Things that added to the bag of guilt that I started with when I was six. I compounded them by putting more weird and bizarre things in there that I cannot forgive myself for, except when I had just enough alcohol. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a live woman. She said, good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Can I help you? You know what I did? I remembered what happened the time before. So I did it again. I hung up the phone. And this time I got another good feeling because I had done something about my drink, and I took another inventory. I had acquired more material things by this time. I took another inventory, and I got exactly the same answers I got the first time, and I knew that I wasn't an alcoholic. I knew that I didn't know how to live, and I knew there was some problem, but I knew I had to perform, and I knew I had to be somebody, and I knew it was getting harder and harder to do, because now I had to hide how... There was two of me. There was a public me, and there was a private me. And it was hard. It was getting harder and almost impossible to know which one would surface when. I decided to try again. That was the beginning of my shaking life. I called Alcoholics Anonymous for the third and last time, November 3rd, 1971. Now, I'm not saying that because I don't believe that I may not ever have to call Alcoholics Anonymous again. I believe that there may be 1,000 drunks left in me. I don't want to believe that there's any more recoveries. See, I want to tell you a secret. These are just my observations, and I don't know if they're true. But I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous now for almost 15 years. And if you're new, don't let this scare you. But the fact is that more people come to Alcoholics Anonymous than stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Most people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous do not stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. That doesn't mean Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. Alcoholics Anonymous works almost 100% of the time. What was true in 1939 when that book came out is every bit as true today. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Problem is that people like me stop with rarely have we seen a person fail and don't want to listen to about anything about thoroughly following any path. And I'm afraid that if I go out again, I may not have the ability to come back. Because I see a lot of people go out and never come back. And I don't want to play Russian roulette with my life, and so that November 3rd, 1971, hopefully is the last time, the only time balance in my life that I'll call it's Anonymous. And I got a live woman, and I'll never forget what she said. She said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous." I thought, my God, they must have a script. They all say the same thing. She says, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I drink a lot, and I've got some trouble." And she said, "What's your name?" I said, "What's my name?" I thought to myself, why did you want to know my name? You see, I don't want anybody to know that I'm making this phone call. To make this phone call disgusts me. It means that I'm out of control. It means that I need help. I don't want to need help. If you know I need help, you're going to know I'm weak. And if you know I'm weak, you're not going to want anything to do with me. I said, lady, I don't want to give you my name. I said, this is an anonymous program. I could figure that one out. She said, not only do I need your name, I want your phone number, I want your age, and I want to know what you do for a living. I thought, oh my God. She said, because you see, what we are volunteers. If you give me that information, I'm going to pass that information along to somebody who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're going to call you. And they will tell you about Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, when will they call? She says, about 6 o'clock. This is 9 o'clock in the morning. I tell her my name. I give her my age. I give her my phone number. And then I say, I'm a lawyer. She said, what? I said, I'm a lawyer. She said, what? I said, I'm a lawyer. She didn't say anything. I thought she didn't hear me. You see, I'm so crazy that on November 3rd, 1971, I thought I was the first lawyer that ever called Alcoholics Anonymous. She said to me, I'll have somebody call you. I said, 6 o'clock? She said, yeah. I said, lady, you don't know anything about alcoholism. I said, I'm not going to need you at 6 o'clock. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. I have had remorse and guilt, and I've woken up frightened and pitiful and sorry 5,000 times. But I take inventories, and those inventories prove to me that I'm not really an alcoholic, and then I have a couple of drinks just to stop the shakes, and everything is okay for a while. And I've done that 1,000 times. I've got to talk to somebody now, because by 6 o'clock, I won't want to talk to him again. She said, you're that serious about your problem. I thought, problem? Who's talking about a problem? I don't know. She said, you go to a place in Chicago, it's open 24 hours a day, and there's people there from Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can go there and talk to them. I thought, that's what I will do. So I got up that morning, and I had just come back from some trip where I was getting a suntan. And I put on the most beautiful silk suit you ever saw in your life, and I put on a red silk tie, and I had blue patent leather shoes, and I put on a gold watch and a gold stick pin and cufflinks. And we used to, in those days, have this little gold thing that went around tie. I put that on, and I got my new Cadillac, and I drove to join Alcoholics Anonymous. No big deal. Now, I did all those things because those things had fooled a lot of people. And I was sure that when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous like that, you too would look me in the eye and say, listen, see, you're not an alcoholic. What you are is a sensitive guy who's got a lot of responsibilities. And you've had a lot of bad things happen to you during your life, and you take them too seriously. Because you see, here are alcoholics, and there would be that picture of that old, dirty, pathetic, hopeless person. So I tooled that car after driving about 45 minutes into the city. I lived at that time in a suburban area, and I didn't know this address. And I drive to this address, and as I'm driving, I'm thinking, I wonder what they're going to look like. And I realized to myself, the image that I had going there is that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous would have tambourines. I had no idea why I thought that. I really did. I have no idea how crazy I was. So I tooled that big car in front of the storefront building in a Skid Row kind of neighborhood, and I thought, oh, my God, how could I have done this to myself? And I pulled that car in front of that storefront building because I figured they got to see me pull up. And I walked into that room in all my finery and my suntan, and the first person that saw me walked up to me and looked me square in the eye and said, do you need help? I thought to myself, this isn't working. It was a young man. He had a white shirt and a tie on. And I thought he must be some kind of counselor or something. But he wasn't. He was just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I'll talk to you if you want. And I said, I do. I stayed there for 6 hours talking to that young man. I told him every dirty, disgusting, pathetic thing that I thought he could handle at his age. He was younger than I. I told him that I had become something that I didn't want to ever become, that I never intended to live like that. It had something to do with drinking, but it had more importantly something to do with my inability to live as Frank Milos. And I started to cry. And I cried real and sincere tears. And I stayed there for 6 hours. At the end of that 6 hours, that young man looked at me and he said, how about, Frank, if we go and get a sandwich and go to an AA meeting? I thought, meeting? Who the hell wants to go to a meeting? I've been in AA all afternoon. I want balance in my life. I don't want to get carried away with recovery. I said, young man, I'd love to go to your meeting, but you see, I have to be home for dinner. I hadn't been home for dinner for 6 years. So he gave me his name and number, left that place, and I got in that car, and halfway home, I stopped at a gas station, and I called my wife. I said, Lee, you'll never believe what I've done for you today. That's just true. That's how crazy I was. She said, we're having chicken. It'll be on the table at 6. I thought she didn't hear what I said. She heard what I said. My wife had, by that time, long since stopped caring. Because, you see, what preceded that phone call was a number of years of I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Don't leave. I'm sorry. I won't do that again. I won't go there again. I'm sorry. I won't act that way again. I'm sorry. Please, the children will hear you. I'm sorry. Please, I don't want to be like that. I'm sorry. Please, I won't see her again. I'm sorry. You know, sometime after 5,000 I'm sorries, I guess they just stop caring. And all she wanted to let me know is that that's what time they were going to eat. 6 o'clock, and chicken was going to be on the table. And I drove into that driveway, and I walked into that kitchen, and chicken was on the table, and at that table were 6 little girls who had computer eyes. You know, when I was first married, I loved that woman, and I wanted to be the best husband anybody ever could be. And as those little girls were born, I committed to be the best father anybody could ever be, because I knew how I was raised, and I was not going to let my children see that. My children saw that and a lot worse. I never wanted that to happen, and I don't know how that happened, and I seem to have no ability to stop that from happening. My kids had computer eyes. You know what computer eyes are? I don't know if you have them in your house, but I had them in my house. Those little girls had to instantly try to compute in their little brown and blue computers what kind of day Daddy had. Because you see, when Daddy comes home, if he had a good day, he's going to hug you and tell you you're pretty and he loves you. And if he had a bad day, and he may spot a shoe in the living room, he may knock you right off the chair. Because you see, Daddy's a transferer. If Daddy's hurt, he punishes. If somebody out there hurts Daddy, he punishes here. If Daddy feels a failure here, he tells you about how you fail and what kind of defects you have. So my kids immediately, bing, 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 try to figure out what kind of day this is. Are they going to get a hug or are they going to get a slap? What kind of way is that to live? I never intended that to do, to live that way. 5 minutes after I walked in that door, the phone rang. I picked up the phone, and I heard the worst voice I've ever heard in my life. Frank, my name is George. You got your name from the central office. I understand you got a problem with booze. I said, good evening, George. I had a problem, but I went to an AA club. I want to come over and talk to you about it. I thought to myself, come over to my house? Could you imagine having an alcoholic come to your house for a social visit? I lived at the top of this big hill. Everybody in the neighborhood could see who came to my house. Could you imagine having an alcoholic walk in that door? My wife's got new carpeting. I can't do this to my family. I said, George, I'm sorry. I'd love to meet with you, but tonight I have to go to a PTA meeting. I told you I never wanted to be a lawyer, and that's true. But I was destined to be a lawyer. I was destined to be a lawyer because I have a precious and unique gift, which has enabled me to be a very, very fortunate and lucky lawyer. A gift is, you see, I can lie with no thought process. You see, lies come to me like songs to a composer, like poems to a poet. You put enough pressure on me and I lie. I mean, that's it. I said, I have to go to a PTA meeting. I'd never been to a PTA meeting in my life. No member of my family had ever been to a PTA meeting. I wouldn't know a PTA if they walked into this room. But with no thought process, he had put on pressure, and I said, I go to a PTA meeting. And he said, what time is that meeting over? I didn't know, but it didn't make any difference. I said, 8:30. I'll be there at 8:45. Didn't matter. I said, George, normally that would be okay, but tonight after a regularly scheduled PTA meeting, we have a board of directors meeting. I'm on the board. Didn't have to think about that one. He said, what time is that meeting over? I said, 10:30. I'll be there at 10:45. I said, you're playing my game, Slick. Here we go. I said, George, you're not going to believe this, but after the board of directors meeting, we have a finance committee meeting, and I'm on the finance committee. What time is that meeting over? I said, 12 o'clock, figuring he's got to be stiff by then. He's an alcoholic. I'll be there at 12:15. Then I said something that must have made him crazy. I said, listen, George, this isn't going to work. If you do, maybe this is the way we should do it. Leave your name and number, and I'll get back to you. You hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that God speaks through the membership. Maybe that's true. November 3rd, 1971, God had a dirty mouth. This guy went crazy. He started to swear and scream, and he is and was a professional swear. I'm a good swear. This guy's a professional swear. No, he never misses a beat. Boom, 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 boom. He called me everything that he could think of, and he said, you disgust me. I thought to myself, what kind of way is that to make a 12-step call? He said, you disgust me, goof. You know, you think I got nothing better to do than be on the phone with a lying, no good, blah, 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 like you? I can't tell you what he said. I'd love to tell you exactly what he said. It just warmed you up. It really was so good. This is a spiritual program, and I would never, ever speak at another AA meeting if I told you what he said. But I'll tell you this. Up until that point in time, George had never met any member of my family, but he seemed to know my mother. He said, listen, goof, if it's not too inconvenient for you, before I hang up, will you answer a couple of questions? And I thought to myself, I'll do anything to get rid of this guy. He said, what are you, somebody important? I said, yep. He said, what are you, somebody special? I said, yep. He said, what are you, somebody famous? I said, yep. He said, listen, famous, important, special. He said, by the way, are you a lawyer? I said, yep. He said, well, let me tell you something, special, famous, important lawyer. I'm a lawyer.
I've been a lawyer 15 years, practicing 5 miles from where you live, and I've never heard of you. It didn't dawn on me. I'd never heard of him either, but my mind wasn't working. I said, what time can you come? And he said, I'm not coming because you're not worth it. And when he said that, I wanted it. Because I'm a kind of a crazy guy. When you tell me no, it's yes. When you say it's yes, it's no. And he said, I wasn't worth it. I wanted it. He said, if you want to come to talk to me, come to my house. And he gave me the address. And it was a big house in Beverly Hills in Chicago. And I remember pulling my car up in front of that big house, and I looked at that house, and I thought, boy, I better get in a good branch anyway. I got out to that door, and I rang that bell, and the little guy answered the door, ugly little guy, Frank. I said, yes, sir. Wait here. And I had to wait there for about 10 minutes. It seemed like 3,000 years in purgatory. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on November 3rd, 1971. About 3 years later, he told me the reason he didn't let me in is they just got new carpeting. They said that first meeting. I have no idea. But they talked about how they felt, and they talked about that drinking used to make them feel better, and then drinking stopped working, and they tried to make it work, and their lives deteriorated in the process. They talked about fear and guilt and remorse and pathetic kind of living, and I understood that, and I thought, my God, I'm just like them. And it had nothing to do with who they were, how old they were, what sex they were, what they had. The feelings were the same. I was captured by those feelings, and God, I had a honeymoon in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just not drinking was so wonderful. I kept going to those meetings, and I read that book. I thought this was an intellectual pursuit, so I got all the literature that I could get, and I read that book, and I read How It Works. I read 12 and 12. I got all the books on history, and I knew everything that was in those books, and it was just so wonderful not doing those things again. And I don't know, it lasted for about 2 years, and I just was full of hope, and I knew that life was going to be better if I just hung around with those people. And it did. It got better. I didn't drink anymore. And as a result, a lot of the things I had done, I didn't do. I stopped puking. That was one of the things I didn't do. And about 7 months after I was sober, 7 months to a year, I started to stop shaking. And I never thought those would ever go away. And about a year and a half after I was sober, I did not shake anymore. And what a wonderful way to live. It was like being reborn. I thought, God, Alcoholics Anonymous is working. This is just a wonderful place. About 3 years sober, the same wonderful people, the same stories that fascinated me and I found interesting, began to bore me. The people who were so wonderful and looked so good to me started not to look so good. I thought they were perfect people when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous November 3rd, 71, and 3 years later I saw their defects. And I saw the infighting, and I saw that one group talked bad about other groups. I thought to myself, this is not a perfect place. I saw and heard them talk about doing things that were inconsistent with a spiritual program, and they laughed about it. I thought, God, I don't want to be like that. I started hearing those stories over and over and over and over and over again until I could almost die. I thought, I don't want to hear about that drinking in that hospital or that DUI or that prison again. I mean, my God, I'm just so tired of it. And I stopped going to meetings. Because I was convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous had not worked for me. You see, after 3 years of sobriety, I still did things that were inconsistent with being a husband, things that still were inconsistent with being a father, things that were inconsistent with being a lawyer, and things were inconsistent with being a human being. I reserved the right to do a little of those things. But I wasn't drinking. And it was okay. And I wasn't drinking, and I was going to meetings. There's something funny, though, of what happens if you're like me, and you reserve the right to do those things sober, new guilts arise, and after a while, it's hard to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about gratitude and how wonderful and happy you are when you know secretly you're feeling the same things now that have always been in the test tube. The only difference is there's no way to dilute them. And I stopped going to meetings. I didn't go to meetings for about 3 or 4 months. I have no recollection exactly, but I didn't drink because I was afraid to death to drink. But I met by some chance some members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were gathered in Naples, Florida. And I was down there. Somebody directed me to them. They said, you go to AA. Well, there's a bunch of AA guys over there. Why don't you go and meet them? And by some fluke, they were there and I was there, and I went to talk to them. And that was the beginning of my involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I started to talk to these guys, and I told them that Alcoholics Anonymous did not work for me. That it was a lovely place, and that I no longer drank, but that I still had secrets, and I still had feelings, and I still had compulsions to act that were inconsistent with who I wanted to be, and I felt those things every bit as painfully sober as I did drunk. As a matter of fact, sometimes it was more painful because, you see, I could always say, but I was drunk when I did that before. Now I couldn't say that. I just did that. And then I went to an AA meeting and pretended I hadn't done that or that I wasn't living that way. And my kids still had computer eyes because I wasn't that wonderful person at home that I was at the AA meeting. I still had a temper that was hair trigger. But at AA meetings I wasn't. I could say, keep coming back. Isn't this a wonderful program? And I'm so happy the subject is the third step tonight. What a way to live. And I just had to run away from that, and I told him about that. I said, apparently AA has not worked for me. And a guy who's now sober 41 years in Alcoholics Anonymous said, you've never been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone to 1,000 meetings. It was just explained to me that going to meetings was like going to putting a chair in a chicken coop. He said, put a chair in a chicken coop. Sit in that chair for 1 hour for 1,000 nights in a row and see if you become a chicken. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous has nothing to do with stopping drinking. He said, where did you ever get the idea that you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and the goal of Alcoholics Anonymous is to not drink? He said, Alcoholics Anonymous presumes sobriety. I said, presume sobriety? You go to Alcoholics Anonymous so you don't drink. He said, no. Alcoholics Anonymous cannot give you a desire to stop drinking. That you have to have by yourself. Alcoholics Anonymous will build on that desire, the belief that it's possible. That's the beginning of recovery, not the end. And when you stop drinking, that's the beginning of the process of recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the end. I thought, wait a minute, this is crazy. Nobody ever explained that to me. He said, take the book Alcoholics Anonymous and please show me. You're a smart young man. I was younger then. He says, show me where it says don't drink alcohol. Show me in the book Alcoholics Anonymous where it says, do not drink alcohol again one day at a time for the rest of your life, or just one day at a time. And I couldn't do that because I had read that book and I knew there was nothing in that book that says don't drink alcohol. As a matter of fact, the only reference to drinking in the book Alcoholics Anonymous says drink. It says if you're not convinced, drink. Try some controlled drinking and try it more than once. Try it again and again. The book Alcoholics Anonymous says drink. It doesn't say don't drink. And I thought to myself, he's right, but it sounds like heresy to me. And he's right. I knew he was right. He said, the problem with you, he says, you've misdiagnosed, and you have no idea what AA is all about. You think the problem is alcohol. Well, if alcohol is a problem and you remove the alcohol, you shouldn't have any more problems. He said, the problem is you. You cannot live as you without running away from you. The only way you know how to do that is through alcohol. He said, the name of the game is not don't drink. You have to not drink to make this thing, to have this thing work. That's the beginning. He said, the name of the game is change. Change. You have to change you so that you can live with you and you don't have to drink to stand you. And that made sense to me. I said to myself, I'm afraid of change because I know that's painful. He said, there's no pain in change. All these years in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have been resisting change. The only pain that's involved in change is in your resistance to change. Just surrender. God could and would if he was sought. And I thought, God, oh no, not back to God. He said, the way this works is you don't read the steps. You don't study the steps. You have to read them and study them first to get some idea what they're talking about. But to make it work, you got to do them. He said, you've never done them. You've talked about them. You've shared about them. You've discussed about them. But you haven't done them. Therefore, there is no change. Therefore, you will drink again, because the pain of who you are and how you live will ultimately require you to drink again. And I knew he was right. I just absolutely knew he was right. He says, what you got to do, Frank, is you got to stop intellectualizing and you got to make these actions part of your life. That is the program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous. How you change is by taking these actions and doing them and making them part of your life. And you do that easily or easier with a sponsor than you do without. And I'm here to tell you that my observation after almost 15 years of sobriety, and I don't know if you should have a sponsor, but I know that people that have sponsors seem to stay around here longer than people that don't. I know that... I know that people who hang around with people who say, you got to do things, seem to stick around longer than people who hang around with people that say you don't have to do things. It just seems to be, that's all I see. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. I don't know if that's true. But I know that people as sponsors seem to get through periods of emotional crisis and loss of perception during their sobriety easier than people that don't. And I don't want to be the ultimate authority on how I'm doing. That's why I have a sponsor. Who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor, and together we have 109 years of continuous sobriety. That means there's something happening there. That means that if Bill doesn't know, Marty does. And if Marty doesn't know, John knows. And I know after 109 years of living life, somebody ought to know. And sometimes I wake up, I don't know, sometimes you hear an Alcoholics Anonymous as if after you're sober 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 or 30 years, everything gets wonderful. Life's a bitch. That's good. And I do pretty well most of the time now. But sometimes I wake up, and for no ungodly reason, it's doomsday. I remember recently calling my sponsor and saying to Bill, I don't know what it is. I wake up this morning, and I just feel like I'm not a good husband. I'm not a good lawyer. I'm just a kind of a fraud. I'm kind of a failure, and I'm just inadequate. And I said, what do you think it is? He says, you're inadequate. That's it. That's all. And when he said it, I felt better. I don't understand. I don't understand sponsorship, but it seemed to work. I don't know. I learned, lastly, I want to tell you this. I learned about a new kind of a God when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not believe that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous are chosen people. Maybe we are in a sense. But I live in the real world, and I see people. I see real life. I hear people say, there but for the grace of God go I, when they refer to somebody who's not making an Alcoholics Anonymous. As if God said, Frank, you're going to make it, and Betty, you're not. I can't understand that. I can't believe that that's possible. What kind of God would that be that picks and chooses who the hell's going to make it? What kind of God would say, well, you're going to make it for a week. Then you're going to go out, get drunk. Then you're going to come back. Then you're going to go out, and then you're going to kill yourself. You're going to be sober for 6 years, and you're going to go out, and you're never going to come back. You're going to be sober forever and ever, amen. You're going to come back, and you're going to go, and then you're going to come back until you're finally crazy. I believe that God gives every human being the same amount of grace. It's not a prejudiced God. It's not a hateful God, and it's not a God that picks and chooses. If we're all equal in the eyes of God, the kind of God I understand, He loves us all equally. The difference, I think, between the winners and the losers is that the winners act upon the grace of God and the losers just wait for the grace of God to act on them. I don't know. I don't know. These are just my perceptions. I don't know if this is right, what I've said. I am not here to pick any fights with anybody. Maybe that's not right. I don't know. But it's right for me now. I don't understand God, and if I had a chance to change anything in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I would add, where it says, God as you understand him, I would add, or don't understand him. Because I don't understand God. It's too much for me to understand, but I know that there's a force of good. I know that good is better than evil. I know right is better than wrong. I know order is better than disorder. And I know that inside me there is a conscious knowing of what's right and what's wrong. I know when I'm wrong. I don't have to be told. I know when I'm acting contrary to that God within me, because I know. It's called conscience, and I have one. And I don't have to kid myself or try to justify. I know what I'm doing right and what I'm not doing right. To the extent that I'm willing to give up those special little things I hold in reserve for me, I get better in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I've had to do to survive here. I don't know that that applies to anybody else. There comes to be a point in time before you leave. If you're ready to leave, don't. If you're ready to leave, don't. Don't. Maybe the name of the game has something to do with surrender and something to do with change, and maybe that loving God who gives all of us the same amount of grace has given us, and you and I the same amount of grace to make it. Maybe all we got to do is do something about it. Maybe we got to do the hard things, like taking steps and taking inventories and working with newcomers. I don't know. That seems to work for me. I'm here to tell you today that Alcoholics Anonymous now does for me what alcohol used to do and stopped doing. I now put Alcoholics Anonymous in my test tube, and I found a miracle occurs. To the extent that I put Alcoholics Anonymous in my test tube, fear goes away. There's a step in Alcoholics Anonymous that makes the guilt go away, the dirty go away, the insecurity go away, and the sensitivity go away. Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me and continues to do for me when I let it and try to make it happen. It has the same effect alcohol always had, or used to have. So I haven't traded anything, and I'm no longer blaming myself that I'm an alcoholic. And if you're new, please, if nothing else that I said made any sense, if there's anybody in this room who feels secretly, how could you have done this to you, please, you did not do that to you, and I did not do this to me. I could not have been an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, and I used every power that was available to me not to be an alcoholic. I used my background. I used my experience. I used my prayer. I used my willpower. I used everything I know how to use not to be an alcoholic, and I'm an alcoholic. What did I not do? What did I have the ability to do that I didn't do? If you would have given me a lie detector test 20 years ago as to whether or not I wanted to live this way, I would have said no, and I would have been truthful. And yet I did it again and again and again. I didn't have the power not to be an alcoholic. But I do not suffer from the disease of alcoholism. I stopped suffering from alcoholism about 10 years ago. I live with alcoholism, and that's a big difference. And I do it quite comfortably, thank you, when I do what you tell me to do. And when I don't, I find some discomfort. Thank you very much.